Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. Preparations for the long-awaited assault on the Iraqi city of Fallujah are well underway. Iraq's interim prime minister, Iyad Alawi, has imposed a state of emergency and curfews. He has closed Iraq's borders and given a go-ahead for the attack. U.S. Marines have taken control of two bridges that span the Euphrates River and lead into Fallujah. Soldiers have also taken control of the main hospital. Now, one of the key questions in this attack is the extent to which Iraqi soldiers will fight and will be seen to be fighting alongside U.S. Marines. These newly trained Iraq soldiers are quoted as saying that they are willing to fight foreign insurgents, but they don't want to go into battle against fellow Iraqis. So today on the program, we look at what's at stake in this fight for Fallujah and how the battle fits into a larger plan for peace in Iraq and for the U.S. to withdraw. And we'd like to have you join us. Do you see this attack on Fallujah as a demonstration of force, perhaps an overdue chance to intimidate the insurgents? Or do you worry that it might have the opposite effect, once again a recruiting tool for those who want to take up arms against the U.S.? Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK, and we'll be speaking in just a moment with a couple of military experts. First, though, to the latest from Iraq, and we're going to begin on the outskirts of Fallujah, where the Reuters correspondent Michael Georgi is traveling with U.S. soldiers. I asked him where exactly he was.
We are very close to Fallujah, in an area that's been bombed and hit by artillery all day long, and there's also been heavy skirmishes.
I know that it is the end of the day there. Tell me what you saw.
Well, there were a lot of fighting early in the morning, preceded by artillery fire and airstrikes. This sent up plumes of black smoke and white smoke when mortars landed, and it has been heavy fighting all day long. I see very few civilians here on the edge of Fallujah. There's just a few houses. Marines are quite suspicious of people walking around. They questioned them. So basically, they're just priming up for the attack on Fallujah.
Can you tell us who you are embedded with, Michael?
I can't tell you who I'm embedded with. I can tell you that Marines with armored vehicles, many Humvees, basically a couple of companies of Marines in a very forward unit.
I wonder if you get a chance to talk to the soldiers. Are they saying to you what they think is at stake here?
Well, basically, I think most of the soldiers are very eager to go into Fallujah. The Marines, I know, were very angry last April when an offensive was called off or stopped in mid-track. Many of the soldiers really don't know or understand who they're going to be fighting. They seem to see them as mostly Islamic radicals. They don't know much about them, and many of the Marines have not been into Fallujah or experienced major combat. So I think there's a bit of anxiety mixed with enthusiasm is probably the best way to put it.
And do you see these hours as the moments before the final assault, or would you say that it's actually begun already?
No, I would say it definitely has not begun. I'd say this is the advanced stages of the Marines trying to soften up guerrillas in Fallujah before the attack. There's basically no Marines inside Fallujah. They have captured a building right on the edge, on the outskirts, from insurgents later today in those earlier firefights. But it's definitely completely misleading to think that it's begun.
And are they confident that they will be allowed to move right into Fallujah to, in effect, take control of the city this time?
I think they're definitely expecting to go into Fallujah and roll through it and try to crush the insurgents. Definitely. They have no doubt about it. And the prime minister has made it clear that he's given Iraqi forces and the Marines the green light to go in and get rid of what he calls terrorists. So I don't think there's any doubts in anyone's mind right now about what's going to happen.
Michael, just one more question. Any sign of the Iraqi soldiers who we hear are fighting side by side with the Marines?
There are Iraqi soldiers where I am at the moment, a couple of truckloads or so. And they're supposed to have a forward role, but it remains to be seen. This has been said in other conflicts where the Americans actually dominated the fighting.
Michael, I thank you so much for your time. Please take care of yourself.
Thank you.
That's Reuters correspondent Michael Georgi. Also, I had a chance to talk earlier today with the Washington Post Baghdad bureau chief. His name is Carl Vick, and he was just back from a news conference with Iraq's interim prime minister. I asked him who is in charge in this offensive.
On the ground, the American military is in charge. The political decision to go in or not is made by the prime minister of the interim government, Iyad Alawi, as you know, the head of the sovereign government. And I know that's sincere because I was admitted in Najaf in August when operations were constantly goes or no-goes based on what came out of the Prime Minister's office. The question of who fights is a delicate one. The way the Americans fight is you send armor in first after airstrikes and artillery has softened up the objective, and then finally dismounted infantry move in. The Americans speak English, the Iraqis speak Arabic. There's not a lot of great battlefield communication, so the Iraqis will move as separate units and following on. But great, what's the word, public relations attention is given to the Iraqi forces, who are substantial. And yesterday last night, did sort of take as a commando unit this hospital on the west side of the Euphrates. So they see action, but it's essentially an American show.
But on that, there's a fair amount at stake here in the American attempt to try and shift responsibility over to the Iraqi military. Is the battle for Fallujah key in making that transition, Carl?
It's going to be less the battle itself. I mean, the Prime Minister himself just now in his press conference corrected himself. He said, we've given the order to the Americans. And then he said, I've given the order to the Iraqis, who will spearhead. Well, the Americans will spearhead. Less important, though, is who actually takes the city than who holds it, because the Americans are a polarizing force here. And the battle report of all action across Iraq I saw yesterday, there was a crowd of 400 children throwing rocks and bottles at an American convoy. So, the presence of Americans causes things to happen, bad things, attacks. The real future of Iraq will depend on whether Iraqi forces and civil authorities and police can maintain order in the city after the Americans pull out.
How much, in the long run, do you think the Americans and the Iraqis have staked on this battle for Fallujah? They have been at it before, but the build-up to this seems to make it as a somewhat more pivotal moment here.
Well, Fallujah is two things. It's very symbolic of the Sunni Muslim resistance, the rejectionist population of the country. But it's also, as a practical matter, been a city held entirely by insurgents and has been a, we'll say, hotbed. I mean, it has been sort of a bomb factory. It's certainly regarded that most of the car bombs that explode in Baghdad are driven over from Fallujah. It is true that in April, when the Marines had the city under siege, we didn't have any car bombs blowing up in Baghdad. Doesn't mean there aren't other places that they. It does not mean that there are not other places that they build car bombs now. But it is sort of seen as this sort of locus for militant extremism and terrorism. So it's two things: it's both symbolic and a practical concern.
Anybody saying how long this is going to last, Carl?
Nobody's making any bets. In April, with a much smaller force, the Marine General said he needed another 3 or 4 days. In this case, we're talking 10,000 or 15,000 troops, surrounding maybe 3,000 to 5,000 insurgents who are probably dug in pretty well. I think they have bunkers and tunnels. It's a city. It's a substantial piece of ground, but I would think it'll take less than a week. I'm not quoting anybody's predictions, but I'm just thinking of what they have to do, maybe half that time.
Carl, I thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
Carl Vick is Baghdad Bureau Chief for The Washington Post. Chance now to introduce the guest who will be with us for the balance of the hour. Michael Vickers is joining us on the phone from Washington, D.C. He's Director of Strategic Studies at the Center for Strategic and Budgetary Assessments in Washington. Hello, Michael.
Good morning.
Nice to have you with us. And Andrew Basevich is here with me in our Boston studio, and he is International Relations Professor at Boston University. Nice to have you back.
Thank you.
I'm going to ask you first, Andy, just a reaction to what you're hearing from the people who are close to the fighting there. This whole move on Fallujah, what kind of symbolic importance do you attach to it?
Well, I wonder if we're not attaching too much importance to it. To view this as a potentially decisive event is, in essence, to conjure up images that really relate to conventional war. And this is an unconventional war. In conventional wars, big battles decide things. In conventional wars, when the big battle is fought, the winner has accrued some real advantage that can translate into into final victory and political success. The history of unconventional warfare doesn't really support that sort of notion. Yeah, battles count, battles are important, battles need to be fought, but the real result of the battle emerges over time, in a sense, after the fighting may have been completed, when we learn more about how the attitude of the population may have been affected, when we see whether or not the insurgent force has a capacity to regenerate, or whether it adjusts its tactics, or indeed whether or not perhaps the insurgent force is now intimidated or significantly weakened. We're going to win this fight. There's no question about it. But the question to my mind is whether or not we will have gained anything significant when we have, in fact, reasserted control of Fallujah.
Michael, your thoughts here. I mean, I also had a chance to speak earlier today to someone at Central Command in Baghdad, speaking on behalf of the U.S. military, and that sergeant was saying, you know, the Iraqis and the Americans are side by side, and it's very important that we be seen to be fighting that way. At least that part of this seems to be very important in the sort of symbolism of this attack.
Well, I think the symbolism is important, but it really is an early step. I mean, we're a long way from being able to hand off security to the Iraqis. That's a year, perhaps a couple years away. And so I think while the Battle of Fallujah is important in the short run, we were essentially defeated or defeated ourselves in April. Certainly the insurgents believed they defeated us. But it will only buy a temporary victory. I largely agree with what Andy said, that this is not going to determine who wins the insurgency over the long haul. It will perhaps upset the insurgents and clean out a bomb factory temporarily and maybe provide some breathing space for the elections, but that's about it.
It's interesting, though, Michael, how much of the preparations for the battle in Fallujah we've seen for the past week, maybe 2 weeks, newspaper photographs of Marines practicing with stretchers and practicing with mortars and Iraqi soldiers in exercises. There's a large sort of psychological operation part of this at play, is there not?
Oh, there is, and both sides have essentially had quite a bit of time to prepare for this battle. The insurgents have had the city essentially since April, and the battle has been placed on hold for perhaps a couple months because of the U.S. elections, and so there have been extensive preparations. A lot of people have fled Fallujah. Undoubtedly, a lot of the insurgent high command is long gone, although there's probably still a significant core there.
That's something that we'll pick up when we come back after our short break here, and that is the connection between the American elections and the battle in Fallujah and whether or not there was this hiatus, what the effect of that would be. We'd also like to hear from you about how you're seeing this battle. Is this the resumption of a war that you see having been put on hold? Do you see it as having some kind of important symbolic effect in transferring responsibility, however long that takes, from the American forces to the Iraqi army? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. Listening to The Connection, I'm Dick Gordon. Our number is 1-800-423-TALK. What is at stake in the battle for Fallujah right now in its early stages, and what's it telling us about the role the U.S. military is and should be playing in Iraq in the months ahead? Just as we went to our break, Michael Vickers was talking about the way that this battle may have been delayed or was delayed by the American political campaign. Andy Bacevich, what's the effect of something like that? I was wondering during the campaign, do things actually get put on hold? Because at one level, you know, soldiers were saying, no, we just go ahead and do what we're supposed to do. But how much effect can a political campaign
have? Well, significant. I mean, war and politics are all mixed up together. They cannot be separated. And when we say politics affects the conduct of war, we have to include domestic politics. I think we would be naive to think otherwise. So I think in all likelihood, the timing of this operation has been affected by the the just recently completed campaign, and in effect has been delayed, and delayed really in a very public way that arguably could benefit the enemy to some degree, because nobody is going to be surprised when this attack begins. Certainly the enemy's not going to be surprised, and the enemy's had an opportunity to prepare or adjust to decide, yes, we're going to make a big fight, or perhaps, no, we're not going to make a big fight. Perhaps we're going to, you know, leave Fallujah and be able to fight another day. So bottom line, yeah, politics matters. Politics has saturated the way this war is being conducted.
1-800-423-8255, your chance to join us this hour. We're going first to Nashville, Tennessee, and Muna's on the line. Hi, Muna.
Hi.
Tell me what you're thinking.
Well, what I'm thinking is the insurgents in Fallujah, they consist of several groups. The first one is the fanatic Islamists, and then the Saddam supporters. And some of them are just people who don't want to be occupied by a foreign country.
Yeah.
So by just attacking them, to me, it seems like exactly what Saddam had done to the Kurdish people when he gassed them in 1988, because they were insurgents in his eyes. They did not believe in what he wanted to do for them or to them.
Are you from Iraq, Muna?
Yes, originally I'm from Iraq.
And so what you're saying is that there might be a big backfire here that...
Yeah, I mean, I know, when I talk to Iraqis, they are really divided. Some of them just don't want to be occupied. They say, well, America had taken care of Saddam Hussein, thank you so much, we want them to leave. And some of them, yeah, they want to, you know, the government of Alawi to stay. It seems like they are divided over what had happened in Iraq. But yesterday I saw a picture of a hospital that was bombed in the New York Times. I mean, big, big picture. And to me, it seems like by just attacking Fallujah, we are killing a lot of innocent people, and that will backfire on us and Alawi's government.
All right, Muna, thanks for your call. I'm going to ask Andy first, and then...
Well, I think the comparison with gassing the Kurds is not fair. I mean, Saddam Hussein intentionally set out to kill as many civilians as he possibly could in order to intimidate the Kurds. That's clearly not the U.S. intention here. Nonetheless, there's a concern. We are going to kill some civilians, even if inadvertently, and it's quite plausible to argue that, to the extent that the driving force behind the insurgency is Iraqis who simply don't like their country being occupied, yes, then this tactical success that I think we'll have could actually lead to an operational setback. So that's got to be a concern.
And Michael Vickers, the Iraqi president, to be distinguished from the Iraqi prime minister, a few days ago was saying quite publicly, do not attack Fallujah. It's only going to make things worse. I mean, Muna's perspective is clearly something that's even up at the higher levels of this interim administration in Iraq.
Well, that's correct. And the man you're referring to, Ghazi al-Yawar, was one of the principal forces on the interim government in April, urging that the attack be called off. And so he's a Sunni. He's the senior Sunni in the Iraqi government. And he's a force to be reckoned with as this battle goes on. But a couple points about Fallujah. One, it's not just foreign insurgents there or Saddam regime loyalists. It's also a lot of young kids who are, you know, Fallujah is a fundamentalist city, but who take up arms and provide the cannon fodder, and that happened in April. Jihad is good business for Fallujah. I mean, it's a Wild West city. It's a bomb factory. It's not the occupation of Iraq. They just want to be left alone in that area.
So you're saying it's a good thing or a bad thing to go in then, Michael?
Well, I think it's necessary because it's 35 miles from Baghdad, it has been a bomb factory, and it was a pretty significant defeat for the U.S. in April to the way it was handled. And so there are a number of reasons why this has to be done in the near term.
1-800-423-8255 to Dedamas now, and Bob's with us. Hi, Bob.
Good morning.
Tell me what you're thinking.
Yeah, well, I've been listening to this, and I've been reading about the build-up to this battle, and I'm just wondering why we really think that the insurgents will take the set piece battle. I would expect they'd disappear with the populace and leave us to take the city and come back to fight another day.
I think that's what Andy was saying earlier. There's been so much warning of this. It's kind of hard to know whether or not the insurgents are prepared or have the wherewithal to go head to head against the U.S. Army. You're thinking not, Bob.
I think not. The papers, the news on television, you know, it's all like, this is going to be a big battle. It may be nothing.
Well, you know, I think back to, Andy, I don't know, it was 2 years ago you and I were sitting here in this same studio talking about the likelihood of urban warfare and the big battle that was imminent in the invasion of Baghdad. Maybe there is too much made of these moments of confrontation.
Well, I do think there may be maybe too much made, but there's going to be a battle. I mean, without trying to pretend that I have any sort of great insight into the behavior of the enemy, it does seem to me that the leadership of the insurgency does have the ability to motivate young men to go die for their cause, these suicide bombers. And so I have no doubt that the leadership of the insurgency in Fallujah has the capacity to motivate young Iraqis to fight against the Americans as a fight to the death. At the same time, the insurgency is not simply about self-sacrifice. The insurgency is an effort to achieve political ends, which requires that the insurgency
survive,
flourish. Yeah. So we could have something like the leadership gets out of Dodge, while the poor little followers are left to fight to the last man. But it strikes me as highly unlikely that any kind of result is going to come out of this fight that is going to make a major difference in the prospects of our long-term success.
That Michael, that they'll just find somewhere else to pack explosives inside automobiles.
Well, I think there's some problem with that in the sense that the insurgents tried to call for a so-called Tet Offensive to influence the U.S. election, and it really failed. There were, you know, few bombings, some spectacular in the Green Zone, but that was really it. The idea that they were able to pull off a nationwide uprising was very limited, and I don't think you'll see it this time. But I do agree with Andy that the senior leadership will likely live to fight another day. But it's an urban insurgency, and the more you squeeze them, they've had free run of a lot of cities over the last 6 months. That's slowly being taken away. Now, the strategic question is whether the Iraqi government over time can make that stick.
And what you're saying is, though we might not know it yet, the insurgents may be running out of cannon fodder, maybe running out of local support?
Well, they've been growing for a time, but you know, the conditions that have really aggravated them may be ameliorating somewhat as we move toward elections. And I mean, look, it's not just national resistance to occupation. The insurgency is now largely concentrated among a minority population that used to rule. And they don't like that. They don't like the idea of giving up power. And the question is whether you can co-opt enough of them to eventually see that they have a better future in a unified Iraq. But they're not going to rule anymore.
All right, back to the phones to Amherst, New York. John's with us. Hi, John. How are you?
Dick, very well. Thank you once again for your graciousness.
What are you thinking?
Well, your staff is very kind in letting me on. I'm a more conservative, as you know. But I really would like to take issue a little bit with this gentleman. It's a typical professor where we really don't know what's going on. Well, let me tell you what we do know absolutely as a fact today. We know that not taking action causes a Fallujah where we have, what, 3, 5, 10, who knows how many thousands of people sitting in a city that have been able to group up. One thing we have not done is we have not made these people pay for their uncivil behavior. And I mean decimation. You know, when you look at history.
Are you talking about the insurgents alone, John? Or are you talking about everybody in Fallujah?
No. Well, you know, the thing is, there are a lot of sympathizers. And unfortunately, over these past months, and I'm sure your guests will agree, that we have given everyone the opportunity who doesn't know that this attack is going to happen. So that being said, people are going to say, well, the United States is going to come in and really decimate us, or we can get out. And there are tens of thousands, scores of thousands of people that have evacuated the city in anticipation of this. Now, those who choose to stay, they have got to be dealt a very firm lesson, and you have got to make putting a bomb on yourself, driving into a civilian area, and the pretense of 72 virgins, we've got to make that a bad career choice.
Okay, John, let me just stop you there. I'm a little bit remiss in not also mentioning that Michael Vickers is a former Special Forces officer, and Andy Basevich is also a former soldier, was a commander in the first Gulf War. These aren't armchair generals, as you describe, but, let's pick up the point. John says it's time to bomb, time to teach someone a lesson.
Well, I guess I am an armchair strategist now. Decimation as a strategy for winning an insurgency could work, but we're going to have to kill an awful lot of people. I mean, probably in the hundreds of thousands of people. And in the smoking ruin that was Iraq, perhaps we could declare some victory. But Iraq is not the only, and I think Mike Vickers might even say, is not even the most important theater in the larger struggle in which we're engaged in this so-called global war on terror. And I have to think that were we to decimate the population of Iraq, that we would actually find ourselves further away from winning the global war on terror. We would find a world that was all the more antagonistic to the notion of the United States as the sole superpower. And we would end up imposing on ourselves burdens that ultimately we could not bear.
You're listening to The Connection. I'm Dick Gordon. Mike Vickers, let's hear from you. The idea that by being too powerful, by using too much force, there, as Andy's saying, that it can be, in fact, counterproductive.
Oh, I agree with Andy completely. We have to take Fallujah. We have to take it very quickly because the more protracted it is, the more we'll be painted as this horrible aggressor that's going in. And that's essentially what happened in April. And we should recognize here the enemy in Fallujah isn't just the insurgents, and there may be 1,200 of them. There may be more if there's a lot of young kids. But it's also Al Jazeera is not neutral in this. And they're going to be looking to paint this as a horrible U.S. action. And so that's why I think you'll see the U.S. forces with the Iraqi counterparts trying to wrap this up in a few days.
But just to take it one step further, Michael, Andy made the point, and John was quite strong in making the point that everybody has known what's coming in Fallujah. Is it not reasonable at this point to say, you know, the people who are still there have had their fair warning?
Well, the estimates are there are about 75,000 out of a normal population of 300,000 or so. But I don't think that that's really right, that everybody there is really an insurgent or had fair warning. I mean, the insurgent strength is maybe, you know, as I said, 1,200, 2,000.
Yeah.
And so one has to be discriminate. One can't just go in there and let. This isn't Berlin.
And there was a Marine intelligence officer quoted in the paper on the weekend, Andy, as saying that there are a lot of people in Fallujah who simply don't have the wherewithal to leave the city or refuse to leave their homes.
Mm-hmm. No, I'm sure it's true.
1-800-423-8255 to Big Sandy, Montana now, and Doug's joining us. Hi, Doug.
Good morning, Dick. I have a question I've long wanted to ask, and I don't want it to sound cynical, but we are supposedly training Iraqi forces, although we know in Fallujah that the United States forces will be the main action force. But is there really any plan to arm the Iraqi forces in the future so that they could truly defend their country? I mean, arm them with tanks and artillery and mortars and planes and the kinds of things that any army would need to defend its country? Or will the United States have to do this sort of work for the foreseeable future?
Oh, that's a good question. Andy, you can start.
I'm sure Mike can give more detail on this than I can, but absolutely there is a plan in place or in progress to try to develop that sort of a force. Now, it may not have a lot of fighter planes and tanks because the purpose of this force is not going to be to project Iraqi power outside of the territorial boundaries of Iraq, but certainly the idea is to make it possible for Iraq to defend itself. The threat is likely to be an internal threat for the foreseeable future. But our experience in other insurgencies says that that's a great idea and a very difficult one to pull off. It is not by accident that the insurgents are targeting the embryonic Iraqi security forces and creating all kinds of negative incentives with regard to signing up to serve the new regime. So I think that's probably the very heart and soul of our plan to extract ourselves from Iraq in the foreseeable future, but it's going to be a very steep hill to climb if we're going to get there.
We're coming up to a break, Mike. I'm going to ask you to be brief here, but do you think it means leaving behind a lot more than M4s, a lot of, you know, armored Humvees and that sort of thing?
Oh, it does. It's the only way U.S. forces are going to get out of Iraq. We've been abysmally slow at it. We haven't given the Iraqis enough equipment and weapons to date, and we're struggling to get a lot of Iraqis to fill police ranks and others. There's been more progress recently, but it's one of the big failures of the past year, and it's something now I think that folks are trying to accelerate.
And is that a bill that has yet to come due, the cost of that extra arming of the Iraqis?
The cost is actually pretty modest compared to the cost of occupation. It's around $1 billion or something like that, where we're spending $5 billion a month having our forces there.
Our number is 1-800-423-8255. Sorry, Michael, we've got to take a short break here. As a reminder to our listeners, we're taking a look at the battle that is building on the outskirts of Fallujah, just outside Baghdad. It is being regarded in fairly large symbolic terms for the way that Iraqi forces will be fighting beside U.S. Marines. What's the effect likely to be on the insurgency? Is this the big bang that the generals would like to see to put an end to it, or is it likely to function more as a further recruiting tool? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. Dick Gordon, you're listening to The Connection. We're going straight back to our phones to continue our conversation about what's going on in Fallujah and what it means to people there and here in this country. A reminder, my guest here in Boston, Andy Basevich, he's an international relations professor at Boston University and author of a book coming out in the spring called The New American Militarism. Michael Vickers is with us from Washington. He is a director at the Center for Strategic and Budgetary Assessments in Washington, D.C. To Raleigh, North Carolina next, and Rami's joining us. Hi, Rami.
Hey. My question is why they can't negotiate with those people, the insurgency, because this battle is going to kill probably a few hundred of those people who are fighting, but it's going to kill lots of civilians. And the mentality in the Middle East, if one guy dies of the family, the rest of the family is going to join the insurgency no matter what, because they're going to revenge for their brother, their cousins. These are tribes area. It's people, they are connected.
Rami, I was trying to follow this over the past couple of months, and my understanding is that the interim Iraq government actually did try fairly hard to keep a door of negotiations open, but that they were having some difficulty just talking to people. And under circumstances like that, at what point do you say, okay, we really can't talk about this anymore?
Of course they have difficulty.
Well, Rami, I'm afraid your phone is breaking up there. I'm going to go to Michael Vickers in Washington. I mean, this was an option that was pursued, that was tried. At what point, Michael, do you give up?
Well, I think they've reached that point. They did try to negotiate. As you mentioned, a couple months ago, the government, interim government, asked that foreign terrorists be turned over, and the city leader said that was just an impossible demand, largely because the insurgents had everybody at gunpoint. And more recently, the Association of Muslim Scholars, a Sunni organization in Iraq, has shown a little more flexibility, but their demands were still that U.S. forces be confined to their bases and the attack on Fallujah be called off, and the government rejected them.
We're going next to Boston. Peter's joining us on the line from there. Hi, Peter.
Yes, hi. I just wanted to make a comment. I'm a Vietnam combat veteran, Marine veteran. And I was no great supporter of the war. But once they fought, you had to support the troops. I think if whatever they call it, I mean, this is clearly a battle. The 1st Marine Division is out there right now, and the Army guys are going in. This is a major battle. If anybody thinks that this should not be a fight in Fallujah after the April situation, those poor Marines that got killed out there and they had to pull back because it was a political discussion, clearly what they need to do now, Fallujah is the rallying point of all the insurgency or the major insurgencies. They've got to let those Marines go in there. It's going to be tough and bloody, but they've got to let them eliminate it. Those guys are ready to go. They're ready to go in there, and they're going to slam them. And I'm talking about the people who are resisting. I'm not talking about civilians, but that's the hotbed of resistance right now.
And, do you look back to Vietnam for any parallels to what we're looking at in Fallujah right now?
Absolutely. Way City was just Way City during the first part of the Battle of Way City.
Yeah.
They sent the 1st Marines up there, and they didn't want to have airstrikes because they didn't want to blow the citadel down on the other areas. And then after taking so many casualties, then they start to bring everything else in there. That's what I fear for the poor, those Marines and Army people who are going in there, that they, instead of letting airstrikes, which should be the first, and artillery should be it, they're going to be holding off and say, make frontal assaults with ground troops where you take the major casualties. I think they should now... All the political considerations are gone. They should let the men on the ground, the artillery and the airstrikes go in, and then they should go in and eliminate that whole pocket. Secondly, I think the hearts and minds of the people in that area, the Fallujah area, this isn't about hearts and minds now. This is about eliminating the problems that are in that area. And I think the one thing it will be, if they go in and have a good victory, they knock it out, it's going to send a message. You may hate us, but if you keep doing this while we're there, you'll be destroyed. And that's what military projection and power is about. With all the due respect to all your experts, that's what military might and power is about. If you eventually keep doing things like this, we will destroy you. And they're going out to kill enemy combatants who are killing our troops periodically. This is what they need to do to establish, to send the word out. You might hate us, but if you keep doing this, this is what we're going to do until we get out of this country.
Okay, Peter, then I want to turn this to Andy.
Well, I mean, that's a scenario, and nobody would be happier than I would if indeed this fight ended up in intimidating all the insurgents. But I don't think it's likely, and there's very little in the history of insurgencies, at least as I read that history, that suggests that it's going to turn out that way. We make too many comparisons between Iraq and Vietnam. There's no question about that. But the caller brings up the Hue City episode, and it's somewhat informative. And the bottom line is that although we did react to the Tet Offensive with great ferocity and defeated the Tet Offensive ultimately and imposed tremendous losses on the enemy, we lost the war.
And thousands of American soldiers were killed in the...
Oh, yeah. And I just fear that. Let me rephrase that. I see no clear evidence that simply winning the Battle of Fallujah, which, yes, alas, we must fight. I see no evidence that simply winning the Battle of Fallujah is going to make a decisive difference in the circumstances that have us bogged down in Iraq.
Mike Vickers, you have anything to add to this?
No, I largely agree with Andy. I mean, we've been using air power for the past couple of weeks in Fallujah. There's AC-130 gunships overhead supporting the Marines. I don't think we'll be and we have a lot of precision air power. I don't think we'll be shy about using it when there are targets. We just don't want a lot of collateral damage.
We're going to our next call from Boise, Idaho. Don's joining us on the line there. And, Don, I suspect you'll take issue with the use of the words precision air power.
Yes, very strongly. I felt for months that this business of claiming that we are concerned about civilian casualties, given the kind of weapon we are using in urban areas, is absolute nonsense. You cannot send in like 500,000-pound bombs, tanks, artillery, which is a war crime. We hung a number of Nazis for this when I was a small boy at Nuremberg. you can't pretend that you have any concern whatsoever for civilian casualties when you're using that kind of weaponry in that kind of situation. You know, we got what was that report that was published in The Lancet recently? 100,000 Iraqi civilian casualties so far and counting.
Michael, do you want to jump in here, talk to Don?
Yeah, I just disagree with him. I think, you know, war is a brutal business, but I think the number of Iraqi dead is actually estimated at just over 10,000 or so. I don't think it's counting casualties is counting everything under the sun, and I don't think that's attributable to U.S. forces.
The number of Iraqi casualties, this is as a study carried out by Johns Hopkins Medical School researchers, one of the most reputable medical schools in the country, I hasten to remind you, and published in The Lancet, a very reputable medical journal.
Nobody's suggesting for a minute here, Don, that you're making up the figure.
That's 100.
Let's not turn this into a debate over 10,000 to 100,000. It's clearly somewhere between those two figures, and nobody's really going to be able to answer that on this program. I do, though, want to go back to the point that you're making about the use of air power in a place like Fallujah.
Well, I think the truth actually lies in the middle here. I mean, yes, we do have precision capabilities that that actually then make the comparison with Hue City back in 1968 obsolete, and we can hit specific buildings in Fallujah or in any other city.
And have been.
And I accept at face value the statements of American commanders that they're doing their darndest to avoid noncombatant casualties. But, and here's the big but, war is a dirty, ugly, and uncertain business, and we are killing substantial numbers of noncombatants. And we are to an unfortunate extent, insensitive to that, whereas I suspect the people of Iraq, certainly the people of the larger Arab world, are intensely sensitive to that. So it's not Nuremberg trials kind of stuff by any means, in my judgment, but by no means is the issue of noncombatant casualties something that the United States government should be shrugging off, as I believe it has been doing.
You're listening to The Connection. My name's Dick Gordon. Mike Vickers, I'm wondering if I can go to you with a question about what lies not just ahead with Fallujah, but beyond that. The president campaigned for the past 2 months on a very firm number of statements, not altering focus, staying the course, not switching commanders in chief. Andy talked at the beginning of the program about the way that politics and military activity like this is so linked. Do you think that in any way the president has put himself in a box where he is not going to be perhaps as free as he might have been to say, let's rethink, let's not do that, let's try this instead?
Well, I think whoever had won the election would essentially be in the same situation, and the size of President Bush's victory doesn't change that in any way, shape, or form. And that is the Iraqi insurgency is going to be protracted for some time. The insurgents have no chance of winning as long as we stand by the Iraqi government, but it's going to be bloody for some time. The only way out of Iraq is to develop Iraqi capacity, and we have a lot of self-inflicted wounds from our policy over the past year that I think we're finally on the path to rectifying, but it's been a slow path.
And Andy, you're in the classroom. You're probably hearing, as we are here, those repeated questions about what the implications will be for young people in this country. Lots of people asking, is there going to be a draft? You don't think there is?
No, I don't. It's interesting, though, that really in the classroom ends up being the number one item on the agenda. I think the draft issue was created by the Democrats. It's a red herring, try to frighten people during the election. It seems quite clear that the military, the armed services themselves, the military leadership has no interest in a draft. Much is now completely wedded to this notion of an all-volunteer force. And I have to think that President Bush and his political advisors understand that if there were one thing that they could do that could completely undermine support for this enterprise, it would be to institute the draft.
But they still have to come up with...
We need more forces. And I, for one, think that a major mistake that they've made is failing to expand the size of, in particular, the United States Army for this, in my judgment, misguided war that they've committed us to. But there are still a variety of incentives that at least could be tried in order to induce more people to volunteer, and only after they were tried and failed might you have to confront the prospect of a draft. But they haven't really tried to expand the force. They haven't been willing to acknowledge that the force that they began their global war on terror with is in fact too small to meet all of the ambitions that they have set out for our military to fulfill.
And so, Michael Vickers, if they were looking at different options, different ways of fighting the war in Iraq, are they then caught somewhat in that they can't say, well, look, we'll just send in another 30,000 soldiers now because it'll make the difference that we wanted it to?
No, I think there may be a build-up a bit over for the elections, but I think the main thing that will lead to success in the elections is, one, things aren't too bad in the number of areas of Iraq, but also these tactical battles to clear out a few insurgent strongholds. I think if you doubled or tripled the number of troops in Iraq, you would have the same insurgency. This is something that can be defeated over time, as Andy said, but it's not something that can be defeated with force in the near term.
Well, we will be following it, and we'd like a chance to talk with both of you about that at another time. Michael, thanks for being with us.
My pleasure.
Michael Vickers from the Center for Strategic and Budgetary Assessments in Washington, D.C., and Andy Bacevich, again, thanks for being with us.
Well, thank you.
Andy teaches international relations at Boston University. He has a book coming out this spring called The New American Militarism. Also talked with Michael Georgi, a Reuters correspondent reporting from just outside Fallujah, and Carl Vick, who's the Washington Post Baghdad Bureau Chief, giving us an update there. Our program is produced by Alan Cockle, Jennifer Ehrlich, Catherine Fenelosa, Jen Mattson, Virginia Prescott, Christina Russo, Kevin Sullivan, and Doug Sugertz. Our interns are Sarah Baker, Diane Schoberg, and Killian Nolan. Tara Murphy's our senior producer. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.